Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley, and on today's show, I am chatting with Cynthia Dearen, international business strategist and founder of Dearen & Associates, who shares her unique career journey from diplomat to management consultant to global business expansion expert. We dive into the importance of global expansion for businesses, the services offered by her company, and the consumer sectors in Australia that are poised for overseas success. Cynthia emphasizes the need for expert guidance in internationalization and identifies promising growth markets for Australian companies. We discuss the complexities and opportunities of international business expansion, particularly in the APAC region. We also explore market dynamics, consumer expectations, and the importance of thorough market research. Cynthia also outlines a strategic blueprint for successful international expansion, emphasizing the need for understanding local markets, cultural nuances, and regulatory requirements. The discussion also highlights common challenges faced by brands entering new markets and the critical role of data-driven decision-making in overcoming these obstacles. Enjoy.
And then you have to have a critical pathway. You have to have a plan to back it up. You have to actually know the market that you're going into. You have to understand the culture, the regulatory setup, who the ideal client is in the market, whether what you are offering them is going to work, whether they can already get it for less, whether there's something special that's going to make your thing stand out. You've got to understand how to get in there and talk to people and negotiate with people and work alongside people in a way that's going to be harmonious and productive, because that'll make it profitable. If you can't do those things, then you can't go global as a small business. You can't even go global, I would say, as a big business.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Cynthia, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay. For those not watching on video, you should go check this out. Cynthia has the most amazing purple background. She's got one of the best lit backgrounds and that we've had on the show. So Cynthia, well done on that. Where is this background? Where are you in the world that we're recording you from today?
I am joining you from Sydney, Australia, where it is something like, I don't know, a balmy 29 degrees centigrade. Not sure what that is, Fahrenheit, but you get the idea. It's kind of hot and sunny on this side of the world at the moment.
Yeah, no bleeding hearts over here for you, because as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, we're having a minor blizzard up here in Canada where I am, out in Western Canada. And Cynthia was complaining that she had to shut the blinds because it was just too hot, unfortunately, for poor Cynthia. For those, we're going to start a GoFundMe to try to support Cynthia during this very difficult, sunny, balmy time that she's suffering through over there. So, you know, hit us up, podcast at The Negotiation, podcast at WPIC.co, and we'll get her some support over there. Tell us a little bit about your career journey. You have a unique set of professional experiences. Tell us about that journey, how you came to be in your current role as founder of Dearen & Associates, helping businesses expand globally.
It is a great question. So when I was a kid, I definitely did not think that I would wind up doing this job. When I was about 12, I got really tired of people asking me what I was going to be when I grew up. And so I just went around telling everybody that I was going to be a diplomat because it seemed to shut them up. So I sort of went through high school and then kept thinking about it and thought, yeah, I probably could do that. So I went off and did a law degree because I heard that that could help you become a diplomat. And then out of law school, I applied as a graduate to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade here in Australia, and I became a baby diplomat, became a grad trainee all the way back in 2001. And so as part of that gig, one of the draw cards was that you would join our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and then within 2 years, they would post you somewhere in the world. Now, I came out of university with French and Japanese, So I'm thinking, yeah, there's a pretty high likelihood I could get a French-speaking posting, or I could go to Japan, and wouldn't that be amazing? But, you know, governments often have other really strange ideas about what you should do. And they said, hey, looks like you have language aptitude. And I went, uh-huh. And they said, we would like you to learn Arabic and get posted to Abu Dhabi. And I went, is that in Ethiopia? Because at that time I actually didn't know where it was. I think everybody on the show probably knows now that Abu Dhabi is the capital of the United Arab Emirates. But back there in the early 2000s, it wasn't that famous, and I didn't know that. So I was not super excited about that idea, I have to tell you. I had been saying to people as a joke that the two places I didn't want to go were Papua New Guinea and the Middle East, which just proves that you have to be really careful what you put out there. Anyway, I ended up getting posted to Egypt first, and then going on a posting to the United Arab Emirates, where I essentially worked for the Australian government as a diplomat, boosting trade ties, hosting government delegations, doing reporting, all that kind of thing. And at some point into that journey, I realized that even though that was my dream job that I'd wanted to do all my life, it actually wasn't as meaningful as I had hoped it would be for me at that particular point in time. So I actually went off and did a Master of Middle East Politics in London, because by that stage I could speak Arabic. So I thought, better turn this into something. And then from there, I joined the dark side and I became a management consultant. So at the time in history where I was just finishing up my master's, the war in Iraq had been going for about 3 years, and it was kind of going worse and worse. And although I hadn't been to Iraq with a diplomatic corps, I apparently went crazy because I accepted to go to Iraq as a management consultant. And the way that I wound up there was because I was an Arabic speaker, right? And of all the thousands of consultants that were out in the international zone back in 2006, there were about four people who spoke Arabic who were not Arab by birth. And so I very quickly got picked up and found myself working in the Prime Minister's office in Iraq. And I basically ended up spending 4 years in Iraq working first for the British government and then for the United States government as a consultant to USAID, and then as a consultant to the Department of Defense. And what we're trying to do is to put the economy back together. Now, I'd have to say, if I put it in a charitable way, it was something of a qualified success. If you go on Google how things are going in Iraq at the moment, you will see it was not like we got 10 out of 10 or anything, but, you know, we tried. In 2010, I came back to Australia. I'd been away for about 12 years bouncing around the world at that point. I'd also lived in France for a while while I was at university. I'd been in London. I'd been in Egypt. I'd been in the UAE, and I'd spent 4 years in Iraq. And so at that point, whenever anybody mentioned moving somewhere else, my eyes would involuntarily well up with tears. At that point, I thought, I think I'm a bit homesick. I probably should go home. So I came back to Australia in 2010. And that was kind of weird because everybody looked at my CV when I went around trying to get a job. I mean, I'd been away for so long, it was kind of like migrating to a new country. And people said, oh, you have a great skill set. We don't know what to do with you. Which was, you know, a little demoralizing seeing I'd sort of been out there trying to put countries back together. But I ended up running a multilateral chamber of commerce and industry for a couple of years. But I decided that I was a private sector girl. And so back in 2013, I set up my company, set up Dearen & Associates, and here I am. I've been doing it ever since. It's going to be 12 years soon, which is kind of horrifying, but also cool.
Wow. You must like sand. I don't know why that comes to mind.
I do not like sand,
you know,
or hot weather.
Egypt and Abu Dhabi, and now you're in Australia. And yeah, hot weather, lots of sand, nothing that you proclaim to like.
No, because I believe in taking opportunities, right? And if you make it all about the weather, then you miss out on a whole lot of stuff. So my philosophy is when an opportunity comes up, unless there is a very good reason to turn it down, like, I mean, a very good reason, you should say yes.
I agree. I'm the same. Tell us about Dearen & Associates and your unique services offering.
Okay, so essentially we help our clients to create a global footprint. And we do work with government, but our core client base is companies turning over $5 to $50 million who are looking to go global. And what we end up doing with those clients really depends on where they come to us in the journey. So for some very some clients down that smaller end of the scale, under that $5 million mark, we do coaching and mentoring. But for everybody who's in that main pool, we are doing things like helping them to craft an international strategy, going right back to first principles and getting them to think through in a structured way where they're trying to go and why and how we're going to get them there. We do things like helping clients to create international pricing so that they're not just going to a market and sticking 20% on top of their domestic price, actually getting them to think through what the margin breaks look like at each point, you know, their factory price, their company price, their price to a wholesaler, their price to a distributor, their price to retail, so that when they go in front of distribution partners, they can actually have a transparent and honest conversation about how much they're going to charge and why. We help our clients to source distributors and we take them through that commercial negotiation process so that they get the right outcome. We work with clients on global growth marketing. So we help clients to generate leads in settings outside their own market. There's a strategy aspect to that, but also an operational aspect. We create trade shows for clients. So, you know, we've got clients heading off to the United States early in 2025, and we will be accompanying them on that trade show and curating everything that happens at it, from before show marketing to hotel bookings to what happens on the stand to managing and analyzing all the data that comes out of the show and then following up. We have advisors who do outsource CFO for international and advisors who do operational excellence. Oh, and a really important one that I missed, we do market analysis. So again, if you come to us at the beginning of your journey or you're sort of in that exporting journey or that internationalization journey and you've been spinning around like a pinwheel targeting 12 different places at once and it's not really working, you can come to us and we will sit down with you and do data-based analysis based on really large data sets to help us understand where you should go first and why.
I know how valuable these services are because this is a lot of what we talk about. It's obviously a lot of what WPIC does. But let me ask you bluntly, why is it worth it? And I know you have the answer for this. Why is it worth it for a company to spend on a service like this in order to get all the X, Y, Z, A, B, C savings and lack of headaches and everything they're, you know, that they're going to avoid?
Well, there are a few reasons. I mean, I guess if you go right back to the start, you know, closest to home, most business owners don't have the skill set to expand internationally. They're amazing at what they do. They create a fantastic product. But this is a pretty niche area. When you look around the world, there are not that many firms that do this very, very well. And so essentially it'll take a company 100 times longer to do it without help, and they'll probably get a much worse result because they're doing trial and error. So where you bring in experts and where you pay, essentially you are paying somebody to make sure that it gets done right the first time, right? So you're massively shortening the time and the cost to get to internationalization. Okay, yes, you have to invest, but that ends up being a lot less than what you make back. So that's the first reason. Secondly, if you can internationalize successfully, you will just 10x your revenue. And if you manage it the right way, you'll 10x the profitability as well. So, I mean, if you're a North American company, that might not be as important because you're already dealing in a massive market, you know, the world's biggest market, more or less, when it comes to consumer spend. But if you come from practically anywhere else in the world, even a medium-sized market like Australia, you have a very finite pool. So in Australia, even if you sell something that everybody uses like toothpaste or shampoo, your maximum number of consumers is 25 million. That's not that many. So, you know, your pool is capped, your growth potential is capped. So I think that's a reason that it's worth bringing people in because it's faster and cheaper. It helps you get this great result a lot quicker. But most importantly for me, I come from a country where we're known for innovation. So Australians don't really shout about this a lot, but companies here create incredible things. So the black box flight recorder was invented here. Google Maps was invented here. Spray on skin was invented here. The cochlear implant, which you can plug into somebody's head and it gives them back their hearing even when they're completely deaf, that was invented here. And that's just, you know, that's a tiny sample. And so if you can actually get those things out to the world, you have the potential to make a massive impact on people's lives for the better. So you can actually be a transformative force for good. So for me, that is the most important reason. But those other first two that I mentioned are also kind of key when you're the business owner who's lying awake at night wondering how to make it work.
When I was a single young man, maybe just out of university, had my first job, I would do my own taxes.
Not me.
Now, I mean, barely, probably not well. But, you know, now, you know, own multiple properties, have multiple companies, have kids, have a wife, you know, that I'm absolutely paying somebody else to be looking out for a lot of things that I wouldn't know to look out for, because I frankly just don't have the time to figure it all out. And I think when it comes to global expansion, if you're going to do it yourself, by the time you've actually successfully gathered all the necessary data and then gleaned the insights from that data, the data has changed. Because yeah. Asia in particular just changes that fast.
All the time.
So yeah, you're going to be going back to the well.
There's also this thing of you don't know what you don't know, right? So you're going into this internationalization process. I mean, we see this all the time with clients, you know, with all love and respect to clients. They come along and they say, oh, we have this bit under control. And as we dig into it, we realize they actually have no clue about some of the things. And that's completely fine because there's no reason why they should know. You know, they haven't done it before. Of course, they're not going to know. But if you don't get some help, then you're essentially flying blind on a ton of stuff.
As Eleanor Roosevelt once said, learn from the mistakes of others. You can't possibly live long enough to learn them all yourself. Okay. Let's talk about consumer sectors. Let's talk about what are the sectors in Australia that are particularly poised for success overseas, because you handle a lot, you have your finger on the pulse, you pay attention to a lot of these things. So while everybody is somewhat myopically focused on their sectors and they know everything about just that sector, you have a broad overview. So I want to ask you, what consumer sectors in Australia do you think are particularly poised for success overseas?
Okay, so I want to mention three to start. But I want to sort of preface my answer by saying that because of what Australia is, if I can sort of use a generalization in the Southeast Asian mind, so how people think about Australia and Southeast Asia, and in particular in China, means that in almost any sector, as an Australian company, you start with an advantage. And that is because people see Australia as this place that is clean and green and reliable. And people believe that the things that we make here are high quality and you can trust them. Now, that's pretty much true. Like, we have a very strict regulatory system like, you know, Canada or the US. So the stuff that is coming out of Australia is very high quality. And I think that's probably even magnified in people's minds where you come from a country where there have been issues with things like the food supply. So you will know, Todd, that in China, the consumer base hasn't always trusted the food supply because they've been frightened by some of the things that have gone wrong with things like infant formula and so on and so forth. And so that you know, and that is changing. I think, you know, there's probably an increasing level of confidence in Chinese brands over time, but there is still this idea of Australia as this place that makes amazing and safe products. I don't know if you know this, but in Australia, probably about 5 or 6 years ago now, I think it was just pre-COVID, we actually had to bring in regulations in supermarkets about how many tins of infant formula you could buy at one time. And that was because people from the Daigou network were coming in, buying up all the tins of infant formula and sending them back to China to distribute through their network because people wanted Australian baby formula for their kids because they believed that it was the safest one. Now, that is not happening anymore. I don't know if they still have that restriction, but I remember going into supermarkets and just seeing empty shelves. I was like, wow, what is going on here? So I think food is a really important one. I think fashion, especially when it comes from an Indigenous standpoint, can do really well because there's a unique story there to tell around Australia and our Indigenous heritage. And skincare is another one where we're seeing a fair bit of traction and we're seeing brands launching. But as I said a moment ago, really, if anything that you can attach this Australian story too can do well. So, for example, one of my team, Mike Todd, who has been on this show a while ago, he came back yesterday from a trip to China, and he was there with one of our clients, which is a company called Survival, and it makes first aid kits. Now, they are really great first aid kits. The first aid kit by itself is really cool. I have two of them, right? So they're the bomb. But why they work in the context of China is not just about how good the first aid kit is. It's about the story that comes with it. It's the story about, you know, Australia and sharks and snakes and dangerous animals, and how you have this survival kit so that you will be prepared for any eventuality. What was really interesting from this trip, Mike told me this yesterday, was that the feedback they had from folks in China was that they should do a lot of the advertising around the Australian beach lifestyle. So that means not just the beach, but also content that in a Western context we might now think of as being a little too much. So I'm talking about voluptuous girls and bikinis and all that kind of thing. You know, the stuff that in a mainstream Australian context, some people might look at and go, oh, I'm not sure if we should really put that out there. In the context in China, people are looking at it and they're not saying, oh, wow, that's really sexist having a girl in a bikini. They're saying, look at how healthy that person looks. Like, they have a healthy body, they're all tanned, they're standing outside in the sunshine. So I think there's an interesting reflection there to do on what's going to resonate culturally, because it's quite different market to market. But it is, again, to say that this Australian story of what Australia stands for can be, if you do it the right way, it can be attached to almost anything.
Yeah. Oh, there's a whole podcast we could do around the difference in perspective around sexism around the world. You've been in the Middle East, okay? And I have spent a lot of years in Asia. And then you are also North Africa. You know, you can take Europe, the quote unquote Western world, you can take Europe and North America and put that perspective up against a lot of other areas around the world. And if you were to come to this planet for the first time and say, well, geez, it seems like 65% of the planet looks at sexism this way, yet the Western world has their opinion that it must be that way. There's a very, very interesting dichotomy there of views that we could get into.
I'll come back. We can do that show later. But I'd love to talk to you about that.
That's almost a segue into just how different, if you don't know, if you haven't lived for years and just put up with walking down the street early in the morning or late at night or dining in restaurants or trying to shop or get things, you know, if you haven't really lived, had to try to live and survive in other areas around the world that aren't the Western world, you can't even imagine how different perspectives on certain things. Like we had a lawyer on a few years ago on the podcast, and he was from the US. He was a US lawyer, and just talking about the difference between right and wrong and what is right and wrong, especially in, like, because I came from China, so we were talking about that as an example. But how can right and wrong be so fundamentally different, viewed so fundamentally different in other areas of the world? How is something that seems so I don't know, so Maslow base of the essence of a human being, even those things can be different. So it is fascinating. I think it just, you know, exemplifies the importance of needing, you know, companies like yours when you're going to other areas of the world. Now, I know we could go on and on about that. You're probably chomping at the bit, but I'm going to cut you off. I know. Okay. I do this. I tease like this amazing thing to start talking about, and you're like, want to get into it. And then I'm like, nope, we're moving on. Sorry. Let's talk about the most promising overseas growth markets. I will come back to you to speak on about China and APAC specifically after. So maybe leave those off the table for a second. But what are some of the most promising overseas growth markets you're seeing?
Oh, look, that It's very hard to generalize. So, I mean, I think you really have to approach this on a company by company basis, because it doesn't just depend what the company is selling and where they're targeting. It also depends how much experience they've had, right, and where they're from. So if a company is coming to me for the first time, let's just say as an Australian exporter, and they've got this big wish list of everywhere they're going to go, and I'm saying to them, let's whittle it down. If they're doing it without the help of a partner like a WPIC, I'm going to be steering them towards something that sits in the middle of a Venn diagram. So if you think of three overlapping circles in your mind and you write opportunity or market size in the top one, and then you write risk in the second one, and then you put profitability on the third one, you are going for the market where all three overlap. That's your sweet spot, and that's really where you should be aiming. So if you come to me and you're an Aussie exporter selling, I don't know, maybe some kind of a skincare or fashion product, and you're looking at the entire world, we're going to make a list of markets and we're going to look at the data, and we might say to you, the US has still got the most opportunity and you should go there. China and India have also got a lot, but they're more difficult for the following reasons. You know, they've got a different regulatory setup. They've got a different legal framework. They've got different rules around expatriating capital. They've got different rules around the products that you're trying to sell. The language is different. The culture is different. You don't know how it operates. Let's go to the UK first. Sure, it's far away, but it's very similar. You know, you'll be able to translate what you do here to there much more easily than you are going to be able to translate it elsewhere. But, I mean, if you want to just go on pure numbers and just leave aside those other things that I think you need to factor in, if you're looking at mining, you would look at countries like Brazil. That's an emerging market that's come up this year and, you know, just come to the end of 2024. It's done really well this year. Vietnam, obviously that's an APEC region, but it's doing really, really well. It's emerging. Indonesia is one that Australian companies miss all the time. It's really interesting. I mean, Indonesia is literally just off our doorstep, and it's got over 200 million people in it. So, you know, it's a big chunky market, but most people don't really think of it because they perceive it as being quite difficult. So there are lots of places that are growing and have huge markets. I mean, India is another one. But I really think that you have to twin that pure raw numbers and that pure market size with the degree of difficulty and also whether you're going to be able to make a profit. So if you sell something and it costs you $10 to make it in Australia and you can sell it for $20 somewhere, and something that is pretty much an analog is able to be made for $1 in the home market and sold there for $5, you're going to be priced out. And that's, you know, that can be a real consideration. So you have to look and see, can we get this pricing to work in that particular market? Is it going to be worth our while to go to all this?
Right. Okay, let's talk about China and APAC, what you're seeing from those two areas as far as growth.
APAC markets are all growing. I mean, I mentioned Vietnam, which is growing strongly because you have this really emergent middle class, and you have that same trend in Indonesia. The Chinese market, of course, is continuing to grow. And I think, you know, especially in that consumer sector, I was talking to Joseph from WPIC a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, a few years ago, if you were in China as a company and you were selling $1 million a day of sales, so in other words, a day where you sell $1 million of stuff online, used to be extraordinary. Now, $1 million days are no longer really worthy of a high five. So, I mean, I think the scope of it just continues to expand and expand. I mean, I wouldn't say it's limitless, but from the point of view of a company operating in a small market like Australia or New Zealand, it feels almost limitless because it is just so enormous and there's so much depth in the market. I think consumer expectations are probably becoming more stringent. I know, you know, Chinese consumers have got very high service standards, very high expectations when it comes to how quickly they will get things. I don't remember who told the story, but it may have been a post I saw on LinkedIn where a guy who writes about China was just saying, on a Saturday morning, somebody knocked on his door and he opened it and there were two guys standing there holding a TV. And he turned around to his wife and said, "Oh, honey, I think there's been a mistake. These guys have just turned up at our house with a new flat screen TV." And she said, "Oh, yeah, I was just ordered it while I was lying in bed this morning." You know, the guys turned up 2 hours later with the TV, brought it in, set it up and left. That's probably approaching a level similar to the level that you see in the United States, where you can order and just get things. But that is completely different to some other places. You know, it's getting better in Australia, but we have massively lagged behind. So, you know, same day delivery is a very recent thing here. And most of the time actually doesn't even exist. Like, you might get it in 2 or 3 days if you're really lucky. But I think there's a lot of catch up from countries outside China in particular in terms of how they're going to service their clientele. And that's something that people need to keep in mind when they're preparing to go into that market. Because if you cannot get it to the consumer in a nanosecond, or if you can't provide after sales service in a nanosecond, forget it. They're not going to buy from you because they want it yesterday. And you need to be able to give it to them yesterday if possible.
Yeah, you have to understand what you're up against as far as what the competitive landscape is when it comes to those things. It's just the expectations. You need to know what those expectations are at a minimum. It's great if you can dive in and start to understand, well, this is where distribution hubs typically are. This is where the demographic disbursement is. This is where the population densities are. China isn't as blessed as the US to have almost this circular, you know, oceans on both sides. Distribution centers can operate almost in quadrants of the country. China's not quite the same. Everything is still very much eastern side. And then you have Chengdu or Sichuan over there, but it is just absolutely unbelievable what can be done there, both on delivery and returns and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, just understanding that.
And I think on volume, you know, I think it's probably worth pointing out because a lot of companies may not have thought of this, but often when you speak to people, they will go, "Oh, you know," I mean, you might say, "Look, China is a massive market. You know, it's like the United States. It has many markets within the one market. Sorry, you can't just go there and say, we're going to do China. Like, where are you going to go?" And they will say, "Oh, well, let's start with Shanghai or let's start with Beijing," not realizing that, firstly, those tier one cities are extremely competitive and it's hard to break into. But secondly, that you've got tier two and three cities, which you may never have heard of, each of which has as many people in them as a major city in the US or a major city in Australia. You know, Sydney has 5 million people in it. How many 5 million people cities are there in China? I don't know exactly. You might know the answer, but a whole bunch, right? And so there is a massive customer pool that might not be quite as sophisticated, but they're coming on that journey. And there are, you know, pools of potential that you can tap if you know where to look. And it's a lot smarter to do that in many cases, especially if you have relationships in the right places, rather than banging your head against a wall, you know, trying to get into a city where nobody's going to pay you the slightest bit of attention because they already lived without your product for the last 500 years and there's no need for them to start right now.
Have you ever heard of a city called Dalian?
I have.
Okay.
The leaders meeting for APEC was held in 2001. And I know that because I was working on the APEC desk back at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And I desperately wanted to go to the senior officials meeting and they would not let me. So, yes, I have.
Summer Davos used to be held there as well. So it's a little bit known. But I spent 5 years there. And Dalian has 6 million people. And I would bet dollars to donuts that most of the people listening to this podcast have heard of Sydney, but have never heard of Dalian, but Dalian has more people. So there you go. Cynthia, is it really possible to go global as a small business?
Yeah, look, absolutely, Todd, it is. It's what we're doing with our clients every single week. But what I would have to say is you have to do it the right way. So you can't just drift through it. You can't just snatch at things opportunistically. You can't be like the guy who went off to Bali, Indonesia, couldn't find a packet of Smith's crisps, so like chips, and decided he would be the importer of record for Indonesia. Those things don't work. Those are pie in the sky things. So you can do it, but you have to be very clear about what you're trying to achieve and why. You've got to set some stretch goals which are realistic. And then you have to have a critical pathway. You have to have a plan to back it up. You have to actually know the market that you're going into. You have to understand the culture, the regulatory setup, who the ideal client is in the market, whether what you are offering them is going to work, whether they can already get it for less, whether there's something special that's going to make your thing stand out. You've got to understand how to get in there and talk to people and negotiate with people and work alongside people in a way that's going to be harmonious and productive, because that'll make it profitable. If you can't do those things, then you can't go global as a small business. You can't even go global, I would say, as a big business.
Okay, so would you mind maybe laying out a successful, maybe a general blueprint for successful international expansion? What are the key pillars of a successful expansion strategy?
I'm going to give you the stripped down version of my answer, because otherwise we'll be here for like 2 more hours on the podcast. If you wanted to look at the entire blueprint for international success, you can go and check out my book, Business Beyond Borders, Take Your Company Global. That's got everything in it. But let me give you the kind of the ABC version. So if you can think, or if you've got a pen with you, of a triangle with 6 layers in it. So it's kind of, it's basically like a basic old pyramid shape. And in the bottom layer of the triangle, you have your market, right? And I call this the $1 million market. And this is, you know, I was talking before about that Venn diagram with the sweet spot, the overlap between opportunity, profitability, and risk. That's your $1 million market. It's basically, of course, you're going to make more than $1 million, but it's code for that market, which is just right for you right now in terms of what it offers and whether you can operate it. So that's kind of level number one. If you don't have that sorted out, then it's not going to work. The next thing that you need to do is work out your ideal international client. So when you look at that target market, so, you know, if you're thinking of China, for example, who in the Chinese market is your ideal international client? And that is just so important, because if you don't know exactly who you are selling to, you know, the avatar of that person who sees your thing and says, yeah, I need that, then it does not matter how much marketing you throw out into the field, you're not going to get cut through. And you're not going to be as successful as you could. So that is very, very important. The next thing that you need on the third layer of the pyramid is your winning offer. Now, I work with companies that often sell dozens, sometimes hundreds of things, you know, hundreds of SKUs that they could offer. And they want to go out there and just throw it all into the market. But again, that's complex and that's risky. And the point of this pyramid, I'll come back to it in a sec, but we're trying to make everything simple. So with our ideal international client in the target market in mind, we want to pick out the elements of all our offers. You know, maybe it's 3 things, maybe it's 6 things that we can bundle up to make a very compelling offer for that ideal international client in our single target market. So you've got your market, your client, your offer. Then you need an optimized channel. And this is about how we get our stuff out to the end user. So it could be a 3PL and a Shopify program. It could be a distribution arrangement like the one that you would set up through WPIC. It could be strategic alliances and partnerships. If you're in tech, it might be a reseller. It might be straight up business development the old school way. So it can be any of the channels that are out there. But really, especially when you're starting out, you want to pick out one channel that you know is going to get your stuff out to the end user quickly, effectively, and efficiently, and you want to basically drill down on that until you've maximized the heck out of it. So that's very, very important. Then you need some powerful promotions. And this is all about getting super focused, disciplined, and streamlined with your marketing. So you all know, Todd, you can pour marketing money out the door. And if you're not keeping an eye on the ROI, you can burn through a hill of cash very quickly without seeing much in the way of a return. And for a small business, that's obviously a key risk. So we have to have a marketing that's perfectly tailored for that ideal international client in the relevant market. And you need to know when you put it into the field that you are going to get more than a dollar back for every single dollar that you spent. So if you can make that happen, then you should pour as much money into your marketing as possible, because it's essentially an ATM machine. And then finally, and very importantly, on the 6th layer of the pyramid, you need a financial game plan. And this is so that you have a plan in your head, and preferably in more than your head, documented in an Excel spreadsheet somewhere, how much money you are going to need to hit your financial goals, how much you are going to make over the course of the year, and how much you will need to spend to make it. And if you don't have the appropriate funding to make your expansion go to fund that growth, then you need to know how you're going to get that cash. So you've got those six things: your market, your ideal international client, your winning offer, your optimized channel, your powerful promotions, and your financial game plan. And as I said, that's a very stripped down version. That's like the blueprint for international success for dummies. It's not the whole thing, but those are kind of the key things that you've got to have sorted out before you can go anywhere. Now, I haven't even touched on things like IP protection, branding, packaging and barcoding, compliance with different regulations, you know, culturally appropriate communications and all that stuff. But all of those things kind of fall in under those different six big buckets that I've mentioned.
Could you then discuss, and I know that you basically gave us the chapter headings of, you know, and there's a lot more to say about each of those. Could you then discuss, though, the role of market data research in going overseas?
Oh, absolutely. And so this is really about back on level one. You know, when you're choosing your million-dollar market, you should not be doing it on guesswork. Unfortunately, that is how 90% of people choose. You know, it's like they shut their eyes and they just throw a dart at the world map. And they open their eyes and they're like, oh, we'll go there. Look, I literally had a conversation with a gentleman yesterday who has a marketing business and it does wedding awards. And this chap has decided that he is going to take the business into Italy. Well, this was his starting idea, from Australia to Italy. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, and I asked him, so how have you picked Italy for the market that you're going to target? And he said, well, you know, I just had this idea that I would really love to spend more time in Italy because it's so beautiful and they have regions like Australia, so I thought that would work. And I had to say to him, hey, look, this is the worst way of picking a market because you have no data whatsoever. You're going into a market with a completely different language, with a completely different culture to Australia, with a totally different setup around weddings, and with a totally different approach to marketing. Are you sure this is really the right market for you? So we need to be going out there and getting the data on market size. You know, how much of the thing that you are selling is already being imported and exported from the market that you're selling to? What are the key drivers for people to buy your product? You know, and you need to have all this looked at comparatively. What are the barriers to entry? You know, in some markets, if you want to sell fresh food from Australia into China, in the fruit and vegetables segment, there are different kinds of fruit and vegetables that you actually can't sell into China because there is no market access. Australia's been in negotiations with China for 20 years on some of these things, and we still don't have permission to sell. So you have to know, can I actually sell that? I had a client recently that has a cutting edge skincare product, and it has human stem cells in it, human exosomes. And they'd said, well, China's a huge market and there are people with money. We want to sell there. As we did the research for them, what we turned up was that you can't sell stem cells in China. It's banned. And we had to turn around and say, hey, guys, sorry, there's no market for you here because you're not actually allowed to sell the product. So you have to know, you know, on the basis of data, what the market looks like and what it is that you're really getting yourself into. And I could go on, Todd, but don't let me, cut me off.
Well, I'm going to take that segue into talking about some of the common challenges that brands encounter when entering new international markets. So if you could talk a little bit about those challenges and then how to avoid
them. Yeah, sure. Oh, gosh, there are so many. Where do I start? I just get this huge list of them popping up in my mind. Let me mention a couple from different sectors. I'll just tell you a couple of stories that spring to mind. One, in the, let's say, for example, in the fast music moving consumer goods sector, in the FMCG sector, packaging and barcoding is extremely important. So I recently worked with a group of Indonesian businesses that wanted to bring their FMCG products to Australia. And Indonesia has a very different regulatory setup to Australia. And I think it would be fair to say it has its own peculiarities, but on the whole, it's not as uniform and it's probably more relaxed than ours. And so these businesses are not large, and they're coming in and they're saying, but if we're only selling a small amount of this product, do we really have to get a HACCP certification? Do we really have to comply with this thing and that thing and the other thing? And I was telling them, yeah, like this is the market that you're coming into. You can't skip food safety regulations. It doesn't matter if you're sending in 10 boxes, you have to comply. Packaging in Australia has to conform to certain standards. If you go to a major supermarket chain, so if, you know, for audiences in North America, you won't know these, but our major supermarket chains are Coles and Woolworths. If you don't have your barcoding set up in the right way that conforms to the standard here and your packaging doesn't comply, they won't even look at it. You know, you'll send a sample, they take one look at it and say, not conforming to our standards, we won't be having that meeting with you. So, you know, these are things that appear to be tiny details. You've looked at it, you think, oh, everything's great. The barcode's not right, forget it. So that's, you know, one example of a challenge that you might face. What was the other example that I wanted to share with you? Okay, let me talk about one in the marketing space and how marketing comes across. So I have a colleague who is Indian by birth and has spent probably the last 30 years or so in Australia, and she does multicultural advertising. Now, the Indian education market is huge for Australia. We have a lot of Indian students coming here. And so a few years ago, Universities Australia said, we're going to launch an advertising campaign in India. And they brought it along to my colleague and said, here's what it is. And the advertising campaign was all about, come and study in Australia. It's beautiful. You can be free. Become who you really want to be. Live life. My friend looked at this campaign and she's like, that is never going to fly in India. And universities are looking at her and saying, well, what's wrong with the campaign? And she said, who do you think makes the decision about where kids go to university in India? It's not like Australia. It's not the kids deciding. It's mom and dad deciding. Do mom and dad care about the kids being free? Absolutely not. Do mom and dad care about the kids becoming who they want to be? Absolutely not. Indian parents want their children to go somewhere safe. They want the best quality of education, and they want to know that their children can get a job the very second they leave the gates of the university, so they can pay mom and dad back all that money that they've invested in educating the child. So Universities Australia, I think, took a bit of a breath and said, oh, okay, and they rejigged the advertising campaign along the lines she'd suggested, and it was the most successful campaign that ever run. So this kind of goes back to that point that I mentioned about understanding your ideal international client and then making sure that your messaging is appropriate for that client. What else could I talk about? I think, look, in the channel space, there's a bunch of stuff you could talk about. I see companies coming along every day saying, we're caught in this dilemma. We need quick wins. We think we'll set up a 3PL and a Spotify site because we really need quick wins and people are asking us for stock. But we can't really get volume that way. So over here we might set up a distribution channel. But the distribution channel is going to be slow and, you know, it's going to be kind of expensive to get started and we don't know which one we should do. Let's just do both at the same time. That is a terrible idea. You can't do both. I mean, you can't do both well. The more loops you open, the further you disperse your energy, the fewer returns you are going to get for your effort. So, you know, you've got to make clear decisions. You've got to look at it and say, am I going to take the quick wins and accept that we're not going to be able to scale quickly and that at some point, if we get enough money, I'm going to have to go over here and unwind the Shopify site and the 3PL? Or am I going to say, okay, this distribution thing is going to be more work and more expensive to set up, but it's going to give me reach that I could never imagine in my wildest dreams, and I'm just going to burn a bit more cash and wait for the quick wins and wait for the money to flow in? So, you know, there are strategic decisions to be made around things like channels. Running out of money is another one that I think plagues a lot of people. And look, this goes back to planning and thinking about it ahead of time because so many people get hit with contingent expenses because they just don't know what to expect. People go into distribution agreements without proper contracts. See that all the time as well. And then other clients who've been in the game for a while turn up and they say, oh, we're having terrible problems with our distributor. And I say, oh, okay, well, can I see a copy of your contract? Oh, we don't have a contract. We did it on a handshake at a trade show. I'm like, okay, that's not, you know, that's not really going to serve you very well. So many, Todd. I mean, I've kind of told you the first half a dozen stories that come to mind, but we're seeing these things walk in the door every day. Getting your pricing wrong is another one. A lot of people think that you price for international markets by just kind of taking a domestic price and putting 20% on top. Again, that just does not take into account all the pieces in the value chain. We want our clients to go, when they go to have a conversation with a distributor, to have full transparency, to be able to hand over a pricer that says, here's the recommended retail price, here's the factory price, here's our slice, here's the distributor price, and here's what, you know, here's the wholesale price. And to actually be able to look at it and explain to the people who are going to be distributing your product why the price has to be the way it is and where you can squeeze margins and where there's just no room for negotiation. So that one gets missed a lot too. And then what happens is people end up selling and making a loss with every sale.
Cynthia Dearen, international business strategist and founder of Dearen & Associates. Thank you very much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on the show, Todd.
All right. So for everybody who is listening, audio only, don't forget to go over and check out the WPIC YouTube channel, where you'll find the full length of this interview in video, as well as some shorts and other interesting information and tidbits over there. For those of you watching the video and you need your eyes and ears for other things, or your eyes and hands for other things, maybe, don't forget, you can find us on any of your favorite podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, you name it. We're over there as well. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have a guest recommendation or a suggestion for the podcast, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co. And don't forget to subscribe and or leave us a 5-star review. It really helps feed those algorithm monsters so that this information and this podcast can get out to more people. But from me and from Cynthia and from everybody at the team at The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.